This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, New South Wales hospitals prepare for a mid-October surge of COVID admissions, with more than 500 needing intensive care. Also, while young people are less likely to die of COVID, long-term symptoms are debilitating for some. You'll meet a 24-year-old struggling to recover.
I used to be quite fit. I was averaging running about 5 kilometres a day, and now I'm doing a rehab program and I'm managing to walk about 800 metres without having to have a break and feeling like I can't breathe.
And a national summit for a new plan on women's safety is underway, but there are concerns that key voices are missing.
We had to get a fight to be at the National Women's Safety Summit, and I think for us that speaks volumes in that they're actually silencing our First Nations women.
Let's begin in New South Wales, where the health system is preparing for an unprecedented workload in early to mid-October, when demand for intensive care beds and staff is expected to reach its peak. The state government has released new modelling on the Delta outbreak, showing daily case numbers won't peak until mid-September, so the greatest strain on ICUs will come a few weeks after that. Health officials have been issuing reassurances that they've been planning for this moment since the pandemic began and that the health system will hold up. David Sparks has more.
The New South Wales Premier has been saying for some time she expects the worst days of this outbreak lie ahead in September and October. Now Gladys Berejiklian has released modelling to back that up.
We're likely to reach a peak in cases in the next week or so. That's what the modelling tells us, and therefore a likely peak in intensive care beds required around early to mid-October. So that's what the best modelling tells us at this stage, but I do want to qualify that by saying that a number of variables are associated with that modelling.
New South Wales today reported 1,281 new cases and 5 more deaths. The modelling shows daily case numbers will peak just over a week from now, reaching somewhere between their current level and 2,000 per day. At that stage, it's expected that vaccination rates will start to have an effect combined with the lockdown rules. The demand for intensive care beds will be about 560. That's on top of the roughly 387 beds that are typically always taken up by non-COVID patients. Susan Pearce is the New South Wales Health Deputy Secretary.
We've been planning and preparing for this increase in cases since the start of the pandemic last year. And this will be an incredibly difficult and challenging time for our health system as we work through this.
Although that's an immense challenge, she says the state can handle the surge.
My message is to reassure the community that anyone who requires ICU care during this period will get it. And it will be continued to be delivered by our exceptional staff who are out there working every day, as I said, to care for the many patients that we're looking after in hospital, but also those who are in the community.
The state now has a surge capacity of 1,500 ICU beds. New South Wales health clinician Nee Nguyen is an intensive care specialist. She described the planning that's been done.
We've gone and sort of identified areas, and each hospital has identified what their surge. So when we talk about surge capacity, it's an indication of which areas they could expand into. These are places like recovery or coronary care. We know, and you've heard this many times, and many clinicians will say to you, you have as many ventilators as you like, but it's our highly skilled critical care nurses who operate the ventilators that we need. Critical care requires a very significant, a different skill set. But what we do know is our colleagues in operating theatres, our colleagues in ED, our colleagues in coronary care share some of those skills.
And the search for ICU staff has been relentless.
There have been registers that have been set up to call for those who may no longer be working in intensive care but could come and join the health response if they were needed. Our teams have continued to train and do simulations and other things at the hospital level. And so the training has continued, and like I said, workforce will continue to be our biggest challenge. I'm really confident that we have plans in place.
already busy, emergency health workers are getting ready for more. Dr. John Bonning is president of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine. He says the true impact will be felt well beyond the ICU wards.
And in emergency departments, we're going to be seeing lots more of these people in respiratory wards and in the community as well. So once again, if they're prediction of ICU numbers are such as they're presenting, you know, nearly 1,000 cases by mid-October, and the expansion of beds needs to be done. But we would suggest that there's a significant impact on the rest of the system. So patients through emergency departments, admitted to respiratory wards and being looked after in the community.
The New South Wales Premier is trying to put people at ease by assuring them that despite this unprecedented pressure coming up, there will be enough ICU beds for anyone who needs one. Do you think she's right?
Well, I know that they're working very, very hard, and we're going to need to be clever and use other parts of the health system. I'm talking operating theatres and post-theatre recovery rooms, using anaesthetists, anaesthetic technicians and what have you. So they're going to need to take from a lot of other parts of the system, and standard parts of the health system are going to need to shut down as a result.
And Dr. John Bonning says of all the tactics we can put in place to deal with the upcoming surge, the simplest is vaccination.
The more people get vaccinated, the less ill people get. The experience from the Northern Hemisphere, where they have relatively high vaccination rates, show the disease is much less serious, transmission is much less from vaccinated people. So as many people as possible to get vaccinated is an absolute overwhelming message from us.
Dr. John Bonning is the president of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine. David Sparks with that report. Well, Victoria's case numbers are continuing to climb, with today's tally the highest in more than a year. Despite the fact Victorians are growing increasingly restless in lockdown, discontented Liberal MPs are worried they're on track for another election loss to Daniel Andrews' Labor Party next year, and they're forcing a leadership spill. Samantha Donovan has more from Melbourne.
246 cases were recorded in Victoria today, and Melbourne's northern and western suburbs still have the highest concentration of cases. Jerome Wymar is Victoria's COVID response commander.
This is a pandemic of the young, of essential workers and the unvaccinated, with 83% of all those new cases in the last 24 hours being aged under the age of 50.
There are 92 people in hospital in Victoria. 73% of them were unvaccinated, despite being eligible. Victorian renters struggling to keep a roof over their heads are to get more help under a package announced by the state government today. Those who've lost 20% or more of their income in the state's latest lockdowns will be eligible for a one-off grant of $1,500. They must be paying at least 30% of their income on rent, and the grant will be paid directly to their landlord. Leo Patterson-Ross is a spokesman for the National Association of Tenants Organisations. He says the help for Victorian renters is welcome, but their counterparts in New South Wales are getting more assistance.
Similar assistance in New South Wales started at the same $1,500, but has since been extended twice. Now is at $4,500 because the lockdown is continuing for such a long time. And the ACT has also got a similar payment, which is a reduction on the land tax liability. And in the ACT, most property owners pay land tax. So most states that are experiencing this outbreak should be at least considering the same, or if not more, support that Victoria is.
It's hoped higher vaccination rates are soon going to make lockdowns a thing of the past. So how long do you think help for renters will be needed?
So we know that the economic impacts of COVID will be even more long-lasting than the health impacts. We really need eviction moratoriums as well as financial support to continue while people aren't able to find and maintain their incomes at the same level as they would pre-COVID.
The Real Estate Institute of Victoria, though, says property owners are being ignored by the state government. The Institute's president is Leah Kalnan.
Well, it's certainly not surprising that we've seen the state government again provide assistance for renters. Unfortunately, they seem to have forgotten the landlords also need assistance. The minimum, if they're going to reintroduce the rent reductions, which seems to be the case, there needs to be some relief with regards to their land tax bills that they receive. Unfortunately, this government doesn't provide any relief for the private rental sector with regards to the landlords.
Victorian Liberal MPs, worried their leader is struggling to make an impression on voters during the pandemic, appear to have forced a leadership spill set for tomorrow morning. The former leader, Matthew Guy, is expected to challenge for the job. He and MPs Tim Smith, James Newbury and Bill Tilley have resigned from their positions, forcing the hand of the leader, Michael O'Brien.
So I've taken the decision to arrange an in-person meeting of the Parliamentary Liberal Party meeting tomorrow morning. It's time to put these issues to bed because Victorians want the Liberal Party focused on Victorians and not on ourselves. That's all I've got to say at the moment, and I'll see you all tomorrow morning.
Matthew Guy led the Victorian Coalition to a resounding defeat at the last Victorian poll in 2018. He told reporters outside his home today he was busy helping his sons with their schoolwork rather than working the phones to get the numbers for a return to the top job.
Time will tell on all of that, but, you know, we'll see how we go. But anyway, just hope it's over and done with, and time will tell, but...
Would you like to be leader again?
Time will tell. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
The Victorian election will be held in November next year.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, higher vaccination rates for older Australians means that younger people are making up a majority of cases in the current outbreaks. Around three quarters of the more than 1,600 active cases in Victoria, for example, are aged under 40. While young people are less likely to die from COVID-19, or indeed end up in hospital, they're just as likely as older Australians to develop the chronic symptoms that have become known as long COVID. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
24-year-old Maddie Burke wasn't that worried about catching COVID-19, but it became evident pretty quickly that she should have been.
Before I even had the test, I kind of knew that it was COVID because it was such a different feeling to anything that I'd ever felt in my life. And I had this thing with my eyes, like my eyes felt like they were burning and they were black underneath them. The fatigue was insane. It was like a struggle to even stay awake throughout the days.
The Melbourne woman was living in London when she tested positive for the virus back in December.
That was probably the scariest moment of my life because I didn't know the repercussions, what was going to happen to me after that.
And what has happened to you?
So I haven't ever really fully recovered. So I've got long-lasting damage to my lungs at the moment. They're not quite sure really what's going on, but I have shortness of breath every single day. I really struggle to breathe. Like I get out of breath really, really easily now. When I first thought that I'd recovered from it, probably a month later, I went out for a walk just to get myself back into it. And then I felt this burning in my lungs. So really, really intense burning. And that kind of hasn't gone away. It feels like my lungs are on fire when I exercise and when I walk now. I used to be quite fit. I was averaging running about 5 kilometres a day, and now I'm doing a rehab program and I'm managing to walk about 800 metres without having to have a break and feeling like I can't breathe. So, yeah, pretty damaging.
10 months on from her initial infection, Maddie Young's still not better. She's got what's been dubbed long COVID, symptoms of COVID-19 that persist for weeks and months after someone tests positive. There are varying figures from studies around the world about how many people with COVID end up with long-lasting symptoms. Generally, people who get the virus are unwell for around a fortnight. One in three will be sick for longer than that. For a small proportion, it can become a chronic condition.
Patients report that they're not able to get out of bed for days at a time. Their physical activity is very reduced, and in some cases they're not able to return to work.
Dr. Erin Howden is the head of the Human Integrated Physiology Research Lab at the Baker Institute. She's leading a study looking at why people develop long COVID.
So we're really just trying to understand what the effect of COVID-19 has on the body and why some individuals experiencing ongoing fatigue. So we're trying to look at systems which we know have been affected by COVID-19 to see if they are impaired in these individuals. And from that information, we can use to provide them with targeted interventions to address these symptoms.
What's clear so far is that it affects young, otherwise healthy people just as much as it affects those who are older or have underlying health conditions.
That's been the really interesting thing about our study. We've observed that indeed it isn't just older individuals that are experiencing these symptoms, that it's quite often people in their 20s and 30s. And what this means for their long-term health is really unknown at this stage.
Now fully vaccinated, Maddie Burke's recently been sharing videos on social media talking about her experience because she was concerned about misinformation online. She wants young people to know they too could end up with a serious condition like hers.
There was a few people that were big on social media spreading some information saying that COVID really just isn't real. It's just a flu and there's no reason to get vaccinated if you're young. So yeah, that kind of upset me and spurred me on to speak out because I want to protect other people and I just want to put the word out there that even if you're in your 20s and you're fit and healthy, you don't want it. It's very real, very serious, and there's a lot of side effects that can come from it.
Maddie Burke from Melbourne speaking with our reporter Bridget Fitzgerald about long COVID. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, the Komodo dragon, the giant of modern lizards, is now considered endangered. We're going to look at how it came to this. Well, the Prime Minister has told the government's two-day summit on women's safety in Canberra that persistent inequality is driving gender violence and that Australia has a problem. The summit is part of the process to design a new national plan to address violence against women and their children. In his opening address, Scott Morrison pledged that the experiences of victim survivors will be key, but his mere presence opening the event has been criticised by some, while representatives of organisations advocating for First Nations women say they've had to fight for a seat at the summit, and not always successfully. Claudia Long reports.
The keynote speech delivered by Scott Morrison to begin the National Women's Safety Summit was supposed to be to a packed room of women's advocates, business and community leaders and experts. Instead, it was delivered online.
Right now, too many Australian women do not feel safe, and too often they are not safe, and that is not okay.
The summit is part of the process to develop the next 10-year national plan to address violence against women and their children, with the current one set to expire in 2022. The Prime Minister says he's committed to ensuring the voices of victim survivors inform the next plan.
Your lived experience is foundational to informing the development of the next national plan to end violence against women and their children. I want to thank you for participating. I want to thank you for your bravery.
The first panel of the day looked at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's experiences of family, domestic and sexual violence. The National Family Violence Prevention and Legal Services Forum is the peak body for Indigenous victims and survivors of family violence and sexual assault. Its co-chair, Juanetta Dewis, is taking part in the summit.
It's been quite interesting. It's well overdue, but I think just the challenges of being able to do it virtually has restricted probably a lot of that further engagement and discussion that would have come out if it was face-to-face.
But the organisation had to fight to get a spot.
First Nations women, you know, they're the expert in their own lives and communities, and we speak for them. We had to get a fight to be at the National Women's Safety Summit. And I think by us, that speaks volumes in that they're actually silencing our First Nations women because we speak on behalf of them.
Juanetta Dewis says there is room for the government to go much further, with the National Family Violence Prevention and Legal Services Forum calling for a dedicated First Nations national plan.
The national plan, it's an overarching plan, and we need to have something dedicated specific to our First Nations women.
She says issues like housing overcrowding, fear of reporting, severe under-resourcing of services and high levels of misidentification of First Nations women as perpetrators aren't adequately addressed by an overarching national plan.
It's a national crisis, the violence against our women. We're 32 times more likely to be hospitalised, 10 times more likely to die due to assault and 45 times more likely to be victims of violence.
One of the main catalysts for the summit came back in February when a former coalition staffer, Brittany Higgins, came forward with an allegation of rape in Parliament House. It sparked a wave of anger and frustration across the country, with women calling for more to be done to protect them from violence at work and at home, a situation acknowledged by the Prime Minister in his keynote speech.
And what started as a conversation about long-standing and serious failings in this very workplace, in this Parliament House,
turned into a conversation necessarily about women's experiences everywhere.
On Twitter, Brittany Higgins revealed she too hadn't been on the initial invite list, with the ACT Government and Victims of Crime Commission stepping in at the last minute to have her invited as a delegate. A survivor who was invited to attend, Australian of the Year Grace Tame, wasn't impressed by the speech, tweeting that the Prime Minister, quote, appropriated private disclosures from survivors to leverage his own image. Juanita Dewis says if the government's ready to listen to recommendations being put forward and take them on board, things can change.
It is a big job. There are many layers, and to tackle this problem, there's not a quick fix. We're hoping that this summit is not just a talk fest. There just needs to be a legitimate, you know, call to action from the government, I feel, an injection of proper funding and resourcing.
The summit will continue on Tuesday.
Claudia Long with that report. Well, many organisations are crying out for much better, more frequent data collection on gendered violence in Australia because they say you need to know the real nature of the problem before you can design a solution. Well, Libby Lyons is the former head of the Workplace Gender Equality Agency. That's her view. We spoke earlier.
Well, Australia certainly has a problem, and that problem is on the increase. If we look at just the numbers of calls and the number of people seeking assistance to support them and help them through issues of discrimination and victimisation and violence, particularly during lockdowns. So the situation's getting worse. I think there are a number of factors that play into that. And I think that what we need to do is start to address the underlying factors around culture immediately in order to start remediating the problem.
We've already had a 10-year plan on women's safety. It achieved a few things, the 1800 Respect Line, the Our Watch organisation, the Australian National Research Organisation for Women's Safety, so looking at evidence. Were they important achievements in your view?
Very important achievements, but I will focus in on collecting data and evidence. I think that that is really important. I think we absolutely need policy that is based on evidence and data that is collected. And I think ANROs do a great job in collecting data and evidence around it, but we just need it to happen more regularly so that we can get an accurate picture of the situation in Australia as it stands today.
And Indigenous women and migrant women talk about this a lot, don't they? That the data about their particular lives and experiences is really lacking, but you're saying it's not sufficient across the board.
It's not sufficient across the board, but we also need to, quite rightly, as these groups have pointed out, hone in and start collecting real data around ethnicity, age, all of these other intersectional factors, because we don't collect that information at the moment. We just have a picture that gives us information largely around women and men, but it doesn't tell us what's happening to women of other cultures or men of other cultures for that matter either, let alone our First Nations people.
And there was a moment last week when the government put some legislation through on the Respect at Work report that Kate Jenkins had done for the government, 55 recommendations. Only 6 of those recommendations were actually legislated. What's your view of that, particularly in light of this Women's Safety Summit?
Look, sadly, I think it's very much a lost opportunity for women across Australia, but for our country as a whole. Kate Jenkins' Respect at Work report, the 55 recommendations were sound, solid, and took a common sense approach to the things that needed to change, both legislatively and practically across workplaces and government in Australia to make some real change for women and men in the workplace. So I am also particularly concerned that that they stopped short of ensuring and imposing the change to ensure the positive duty for employers to take reasonable and proportionate measure to eliminate sex discrimination, sexual harassment and victimisation in the workplace. I think that's a great shame and a great pity.
So if the government doesn't legislate that, can we trust that a new 10-year plan on women's safety is going to be whole, if you like?
I think this is where we could see some really great outcomes from the summit. If the 10-year national plan talked to and looked to a timeline for implementing all 55 recommendations from the respected work report, then we have that roadmap.
And so Australian of the Year Grace Tame, who is, of course, an advocate from experience for survivors of sexual abuse, particularly in institutions, she's cynical about this exercise. She says the summit is poorly organised, secretive, exclusionary, and she fears it's a band-aid exercise. Is she right to be cynical?
Look, I think probably most women in Australia are a tad cynical at the moment. You know, I'm a glass half full person, so I would hope that the outcomes that we see from the summit provide us with a very real national plan and roadmap to improve the outcomes of all Australians, but particularly women.
Libby Lyons, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Linda.
Libby Lyons is the former head of the Workplace Gender Equality Agency. Well, the Komodo dragon, that monster of the lizard world, is now considered endangered, a shocking highlight of the latest red list of threatened species released by the Global Authority on the Natural World. At least one third of the world's sharks and rays are threatened with extinction on that list as well, and 70% of the world's emperor penguin colonies will be in peril within 30 years. Closer to home, iconic Australian frogs are also under threat. Helen Frost reports.
It's no secret many of the world's animals are in clear and present danger, and actor Harrison Ford is lending his star power to help them.
It's hard to read the headlines, floods, fires, famines, plagues, and tell your children that everything is all right. It's not all right. The Earth has irreplaceable ecosystems rich in carbon and biodiversity. By preserving just a small fraction of these wetlands, tropical forests and mangroves, we can protect our wildlife.
Harrison Ford was speaking at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's World Conservation Congress in France on the weekend. The IUCN runs the Global Red List, which tracks nearly 140,000 species, including animals and plants. The latest release shows the planet's ecosystems are severely strained by global warming and threats such as deforestation and pollution. The man in charge of the list, Craig Hilton Taylor, says around 600 species have been reassessed.
The main changes there were amongst the sharks, where more than were listed as threatened, which indicates that 37%. There are a lot of trees that came onto the red list for the first time. Fungi, lots of new additions to the red list. So close to 4,000 species were added to the red list for the very first time. And now we can put into place conservation actions for those additional species.
The supervisor of the Herptia Fauna Department at Taronga Zoo, Michael McFadden, says the international red list is vital to protecting species and highlighting conservation efforts.
It ranks animals according to their threat status and their plight, how they're doing in the wild. And by listing animals as in danger, it really, I guess it gives them a classification to allow governments, to allow management agencies to know how they're travelling and what kind of attention needs to be paid to the conservation actions for those species in order to save them.
Integrative ecologist from Deakin University, Dr. Tim Jessop, is an advisor to the Komodo Survival Program in Indonesia. He says the Komodo dragon's upgrade from vulnerable to endangered is significant. On the islands where the animals live alone, like the national park, they are well protected. But it's the population that coexists with humans that needs help. They've lost more than 10% of their habitat.
You know, it's clearly tragic for a number of different reasons. And coupling of, you know, historically small population sizes of only, you know, a couple of thousand adult individuals alongside contemporary range loss in non-protected areas or non-protected habitat, it's probably triggered the increase in endangerment.
Australian researchers recently released a report showing that 26 frogs are at risk of extinction and four species could be lost already. Michael McFadden says they included some of the country's most iconic frogs.
They include the southern corroboree frog, which it's a small frog. It's only about 2.5 to 3 centimetres long, found up in Kosciuszko National Park. It's really vivid yellow and black striping. At Taronga Zoo in Sydney, we have over 400 of them in a breeding colony. However, in the wild, there's almost none left.
Now the IUCN will work with Australian researchers to see which of those frogs will be added to the International Red List, hopefully paving the way for more conservation efforts.
Helen Frost with that report, and that's PM for this Monday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. Hear us at the PM webpage or on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to the PM podcast. And don't forget The Signal, an ABC News podcast, weekday mornings, analysing one big story.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.